From Interfaith Alliance, this is State of Belief Radio. I'm your host, Reverend Welton Gaddy, broadcasting this week from Monroe, Louisiana.
The number of times I cross the street, the number of times that I don't say anything to anybody, the number of times I sit down with my face to the wall and say, I need energy for the next steps. That's where the prophetic and the mystical come together.
For 50 years, Sister Joan Chittister has passionately advocated on behalf of peace, human rights, women's issues, and church renewal. A dissident who deeply loves her religious tradition, Sister Joan was last on our show in 2019 with a different kind of book just out, titled The Monastic Life, 50 Simple Practices for a Contemplative and Fulfilling Life. It's high time to have Sister Joan Chittister back on State of Belief Radio.
Día de los Muertos, or Day of the Dead, is not the Mexican version of America's Halloween, but a 3,000-year-old celebration shaped by the indigenous pagan celebrations coming together with the Roman Catholic Church's All Saints Day and All Souls Day.
The second day of November is observed as the Day of the Dead, particularly in Mexico. It is expanded both geographically and culturally, and the Day of the Dead tribute is now celebrated by a network of secular groups in the United States. We'll take a look at this fascinating development with co-founder Victoria Della Torre.
A joint statement from the World Jewish Congress and the Muslim World League to the United Nations Human Rights Council in Geneva on protecting human rights for all. The first joint statement presented by Jewish and Muslim representative groups before a UN body.
History was made this week at the United Nations as threats have escalated across the globe. This is an important interfaith step, and we'll get the details.
I'm Ray Kirstein at the intersection of religion, politics, and hope. This week, a comprehensive values-based campaign launched under the title Partnering Against Hate. The campaign from Interfaith Alliance brings together faith communities to challenge the growing wave of hate and hostility poisoning so many relationships and communities right now, and offering a Partnering Against Hate toolkit. More information is up at interfaithalliance.org. That's interfaithalliance.org. Here's the latest piece of expertly crafted agitprop from the ironically named Family Research Council. Democrats are purging the military of God-fearing Christian Republicans with President Biden's life-saving COVID vaccine mandate. That's right, the same multimillion-dollar self-styled religious values front group for partisan dominionism that loudly cheered the previous president's capricious attempt to kick out dedicated transgender service members is now bleating that it's politics that are at play in an attempt to keep our brave troops healthy and alive. This after a year of endlessly undermining public faith in masks and vaccines and creating religious objections to both out of whole cloth. And the Southern Baptist Convention may claim to follow divine direction for its political dominance and dominionist demands, but even SBC leadership can't always get by on prayer alone. That's why Georgia pastor Mike Stone is hauling former SBC ethics head Russell Moore into court, asking for $750,000 for defaming Stone and costing him the presidency of the denomination, according to the lawsuit. Moore's had a target on his back in general since breaking with the SBC's lockstep worship of former President Donald Trump a couple of years ago.
Our program airs every weekend on radio stations nationwide and is available as a podcast on iTunes and other leading podcast platforms. I urge you to subscribe to it. You can do it today. State of Belief Radio is made possible in great part by the generous support of our listeners. If you've made a donation this week, know how grateful we are for that support. If you haven't pitched in yet, information on how you can help keep this show on the air is available at stateofbelief.com. That's stateofbelief.com. And now to our first guest. Sister Joan Chittister has written some 60 books and has spent half a century in the public eye as an articulate advocate for greater inclusion of women in the life of the church, as well as more openness on various social issues, dissenting when she needed to and inspiring millions in the process. Taking an inward look with her latest book, The Monastic Life, 50 Simple Practices for a Contemplative and Fulfilling Life, she's back with us again on State of Belief Radio. I always look forward to talking with her. I learn from her. Sister Joan, it's very nice to have you with us again.
Well, Weldon, as you know so well, I've watched you over the years, seeing the phenomenal presence you have to so many of us across every denomination, because that's where God really is. And you've known it a long time before the commissions and conferences were willing to say it out loud. I'll always be grateful to you for that. I know where the root of that tree came from.
Well, you're very, very kind. Thank you. You know, it feels like our world is ever more superficial and noisy. What a time for a book encouraging people to turn inward and go deeper. Is this growing intensity part of what prompted you to write this book at this time?
Well, I'll tell you very clearly. In the first place, we have to understand that those things are the centerpiece and the pillar of the monastic life in any era at any time. That's fine. We've been around for 1,500 years. It must work. Or at least somebody should ask how we managed to stay there that long. But where this book is concerned, this book on the monastic heart and its development, how you develop a monastic heart in the middle of all the noise that you're talking about, and that you will see vibrating within these pages, because I honestly, Weldon, do not understand how it is that people find any calm for their center in this frenetic society. Having said that, it really wasn't that drove me to write this either. Believe it or not, every answer to everything in this day and age is COVID, and all I'm going to do is join the party. Why was and where is COVID in this thing? No place, not on one page and not in one word. But I looked around, and about 9-10 months into COVID, and began to worry. I began to see not only that we were in the middle of a global calamity, no matter what we intended to call it, but that it was being met by a deep frailty in the society. And yet there was only one, you know, there's only one way out, and that's through. We needed endurance. We needed something that could bring some certainty to faith. I mean, the churches were closed. The commissions were down. The conferences were off. Where did people go? Yeah. They couldn't even see their best friends. They weren't taking the walk by the river anymore to say, Weldon, I'm so tired. How am I going to catch up with this? And my friend, with all his wisdom, would say, well, now, Joan, I want you to stop for a day. That's what I want you to do. And I want you just to listen for God. God's there. Don't worry about it. Yeah. We were lacking all of those, all of those pieces of life were gone.
Yeah.
And so I said to myself, Joan, where are people going to go to find a way out of this, or at least to sustain themselves as they went through it? They couldn't go to their churches. The door was closed and nobody was in the pulpit. And the prayer groups were, well, they were a little uncertain about grouping anymore. So that means whatever I'm finding that I want to talk about in the scripture, I can't even do that. So I said, well, look, Joan, what people need right now is not, they don't need tricks and tips. They need a sense of internal resources in themselves. Mm-hmm. They need something that they can rely on to nourish their own tenacity. They had to have something that assured them that the faith that they were used to practicing on the street at certain hours was just as strong within them as they could ever find it in any institution. Mm-hmm. So I decided that I would try to answer the question, how can we cultivate the spiritual part of us when we're being worn down? Mm-hmm. How yeah. can we come to believe that what wears us down is exactly what builds us up and prepares us for the next collapse that we absolutely can't see? So where do you go to do that, Joan? There's only one place. What else do you know, Joan, mm-hmm. that has survived over so much time that you can't say, but these people never had it hard. These people didn't understand what this was like. So I went, well, to find the wisdom of the past mm-hmm. that we could assume as correct, because historians and spiritual leaders have been talking to us about it for over 1,500 years. We now need things that last, and monasticism lasts. Yeah. Monasticism has lasted and is lasting through this too, mm-hmm. and it will give us depth. It'll give us stolidity. When everything else around us feels like it's breaking down, we won't feel like it's breaking down. And it will also help us prioritize our values. We have to have happiness now. Yeah. Where do we get it? Where's real happiness in my life? So that's what this book is about.
Yeah.
Finding within yourself, cultivating within yourself what we have known for hundreds of years to be true to the development of the spiritual life in hard times.
And I'm really hoping that maybe some people who've never picked up one of your books will see what this is about and pick it up and see the wisdom that you are giving all of us.
Well, one thing, I set it up like this. Well, every essay, and they're all short, 4 pages at most, are divided into 2 parts. For instance, the very first chapter is on bells. Now, funny first chapter, isn't it, on the spiritual life? But the question that I'm asking is, why are there bells in every monastery? Why? You can't see a Benedictine monastery that doesn't have a bell tower and that they're serious about. What did your novice mistress tell you that bells were about, Joan? She told us that when the bell rang and we were in the laundry folding sheets for the rest of the community, that when that bell rang, we were to stop a minute and make a kind of acknowledgement of the presence of God, a conscious acknowledgement. Here I am folding sheets, but it's okay.
Hmm. Yeah.
And then I ask in the second part, is there any way that you and I can take this bell metaphor that is supposed to be calling us back to remember what's really important in our life? Can we take that and figure out how to find our own bell? We all have a bell.
Yeah.
We have something that is consuming every major thought we have every day.
Mm-hmm.
And I have to ask myself, is this bell calling me to God or away? Yeah. Is it calling me to serenity or to chaos? Is it calling me to faith or to despair?
Yeah.
I have to get it together. How do we get it together again?
Mm-hmm.
We find ourselves the bell that'll keep us, our mind straight.
How have you yourself walked the line between public engagement and tireless activism on the one hand and an appreciation for how essential contemplation and reflection are on the other hand?
Let the oratory be what it is called. Why? What's that mean? It means that, remember, these weren't churches. These were monasteries. The oratory was a little prayer room. It's where you could go and sit down in the quiet and the cool darkness of the monastery and give yourself a consciousness of quiet and stability and faith without doing much at all. What it's saying is we all need a place where we go when what we're doing needs air, needs oxygen. Where does the prophetic activity come from? Nobody knows better than you. It comes from what I've been building in my heart in those scriptures five times a day, every day of my life. Mm. Now, when that seed goes that deep and is watered that much, there's an oratory in the heart waiting for you. Mm-hmm. And when your activity fails, you write to the congressman and you say, you've got to take care of these older people and we have to have more resources to do that. And you see that month after month after month, no matter how many times you write to how many people you get, it's not being done. But remember to make the oratory what it is called. Mm-hmm. Find that place. Never mind all the prayers you've written in your life. Just go in, sit down in the dark, feel the quiet air. Say, God, I know you're here. I know you're in me. I know you're holding me up. I don't have a clue what else to do. I've written to these clowns 100 times and nothing is changing for the older people in our diocese. I don't know what to do, but I'm going to let you do it in me. And I'm going to sit here for a while.
Sister Joan, I recently have had the pleasure of interviewing Father Charles Curran on this show. And we spent time talking about how disagreement seems to threaten leaders, both church and secular, a lot more than it used to. What's your take on that?
Well, I think leadership was easy when it came in an alphabet of 26 letters and everybody knew where to go for the answer. When it was a canon law book and it wasn't paragraph 2, 1302, it was paragraph 3, but I could find it. I'm now at a place where I'm on a rope bridge. I am not swinging off of any steel strip whatsoever. That everything under me is moving. Every question that used to be asked A is now being asked B. Every single thing that I thought I wanted is gone. Every single intuition in me that if I just did what the pastor said, I should be holy, and why don't I feel it? Because the pastor's got his own problems mm-hmm. right now. Yeah. And he ought to be looking for a spiritual director that tells him, don't worry about the answers. The answers will find their way through this period. What you have to be concerned about is holding people up as they ask the questions. Mm-hmm. We're about more than questions and answers. But we have come from a period of a couple hundred years where we had every answer, whether people asked the question or not. Mm-hmm. And that's where the clergy, the episcopacy, the leadership of every denomination, there isn't one I know of that isn't shimmering from the same problems. All of the old answers are now in question, and all of the new questions have yet to be answered. Mm-hmm. And in the meantime, this walk from Jerusalem to Galilee and from Galilee back to Jerusalem is a bumpy one.
Yeah,
that is our task.
Yeah. There are powerful circles within the Catholic Church who are treating even Pope Francis as some kind of dissident. What does that portend for the future? What do you do with your worries?
my life is not about the church. It's about the life of Jesus. Mm. It's about the Jesus story. Mm. And it's about those terrible moments of attack, those terrible moments of separation and division, the time when some people turned away and other people were lost, didn't know how to go about this. This is a crossover point in the life of the church. It has had many, and this particular pope knows that. And he's not trying to give a lot of answers. He's trying to raise the questions that must be raised. They don't want those questions. They want their answers, and they want their power, and they want their control, and this church does not belong to them, but they think it does. This church is the church of Jesus, as is every Christian church anywhere on the globe and in the world, and the Jesus story is our story. Mm. That means we'll get a bit of applause, we'll get a lot of threats, we'll get a great deal of uncertainty, and at the end of it all, we'll know it's right. Mm. We'll know that what we did was right. Mm. Did we win? No, but it was right to go. Did we persuade anybody? Probably not. Mm-hmm. But what we gave them was a witness of possibility, of the possibility of another way to think that is equally holy and equally Christic and equally magnetic. Mm. So I see it. I watch it just like you're talking about. Mm-hmm. I find it very painful. But I look at this pope, and every day more and more I respect him. And I recognize that he's not going to get anything done mm-hmm. in the Republican sense of the word. Mm-hmm. He's not going to be able to say, well, now, here's the big thing I did as Pope. What he is doing is preparing us to think. He's not giving us answers. Mm-hmm. He's saying these are all very important questions. Mm-hmm. We really have to deal with things. So I'm going to ask some people to come over here and talk about that, some people to go back there and talk about that. And in the meantime, the dissidents, who ironically enough, for the last 25 years have declared themselves holy. They, if you ask a question, you had no right to ask that question mm-hmm. in the Catholic Church. And now all of a sudden, the Pope of the Catholic Church says, here's a good question for you. You really ought to be thinking about that. Mm. And they're scared to death, because when you start asking questions that don't have ready-made answers, you know, pretty soon, as Rainer said, that those questions will grow into answers themselves. That's exactly what they do not want. Mm-hmm. They want the old answer on page 1312 when we have a new question and the Pope is telling us to go in that direction. I'll stay with that if you don't mind.
Okay. What are the concrete reasons that you advocate the practices presented in this book, and what does that do for the individual or for society as a whole?
Well, I don't believe in baked religion. I believe, just what I finished saying, that we grow in and out of questions and answers. And in a period as uncertain as this one, with so many instruments in our hands to deal with it, it's really terribly important that we allow ourselves to work more on the inside now, more on the inside. We don't have to worry about going to every potluck supper every Wednesday, you know, down on the beach. Mm-hmm. We're really not worrying as much about the ladies' guild in the church once a month. Right now, our spiritual task is to look at some of these practices. How do you practice serenity? Mm-hmm. What kind of, are you just whipping off the prayers? Or are you becoming a prayerful person, a conscious person? Do you read the scripture or do you imbibe the scripture? Are you wrestling with that scripture the way the scripture wants you to wrestle with it? These practices are simple things, so simple. But it means, for instance, we have a prayer segment in the community. We have Lauds and Vespers, two periods of Lectio Divina, and then noon prayer as such. Lauds is the prayer for morning praise. Now, the interesting thing is when you come to the monastery and you look at Lauds, as I did at the age of 16, and it says you're getting up at 5:30, 6 o'clock in the morning, and the first prayer that hits you in the head is, "Oh, God, what a wonderful day. I thank you so much for everything that you've done for me in it." I said, "Nobody's done anything for me yet. What is this all about?" It says, "Get your attitude right, kid. Start your day right. Start your day accepting the day, because whatever happens there is going to grow you a little bit more. And then you can come back at night and say Vespers." And the Vespers is all about gratitude. I made it. I got from Lauds to Vespers. I'm still here. I'm still happy. I'm still working. Things are great. It's an attitude of mind. It's an attitude toward the spiritual life. It means there's so much in me to be shaped and touched that really, I'm COVID or no COVID, everything's locked down. But inside, I'm very active. I'm very ready to look at every single thing I have been taught since I was a kid and ask myself, "All right, Smarty, what do you think about that now?"
Sister Joan Chittister is a renowned author, public speaker, theologian, and activist. She is a past president of the Leadership Conference of Women Religious and continues to be active with the Global Peace Initiative of Women. Her latest book is titled The Monastic Life, 50 Simple Practices for a Contemplative and Fulfilling Life. Joan, thank you for taking the time today to be with us on State of Belief Radio.
God bless you, Weldon. You embody everything I believe in. God bless you always.
Thank you so much. We need to take another break, but there's lots more still to come on this week's show. Up next, a secular Day of the Dead on December the 2nd, and later, a coalition of Jews and Muslims calls on the UN for greater protections of religious freedom. Now, if you miss any part of today's program, you can hear full episodes of State of Belief anytime on our website. You'll also find links to the topics we discussed this week, extended interviews and transcripts, and an archive of past shows. All of that at stateofbelief.com. I'm Welton Gaddy. You're listening to State of Belief Radio, religion and radio done differently. It's been happening for a few years now, the traditional Day of the Dead observance on November 2nd has been bringing together a number of secular groups, and ahead of this year's observance, I wanted to get the details. And so joining me now is Victoria Della Torre, co-founder of Day of the Dead Secular. Victoria, welcome to our show.
Hello, Welton. Thank you for having me.
Not everyone is familiar with the origins of this tradition in a religious context, so let's begin with some background.
Of course. course. So traditionally, Day of the Dead has been celebrated after Halloween. It's kind of a three-day event. You have Halloween, All Saints Day, and then All Souls Day, which is where we come in and we wanted to celebrate Day of the Dead, so November 2nd. So traditionally, this has been a very Catholic-influenced holiday. You have origins, indigenous origins, and then, of course, the spiritual origins with Catholicism. But we really found that there's just this gap that needs to be filled for those of us who are Hispanic who aren't religious. Almost 30% of Hispanics now identify as non-religious, and people are just, those numbers are growing. And it's great, but when you don't have a home for those traditions that you held so close to your heart, you kind of miss out on those. And Margaret Downey and I, the president of the Freethought Society, she's Hispanic as well. She's Puerto Rican. And we just really felt like we wanted to provide that for different Hispanic communities who aren't religious. Of course, this event is, of course, it can be celebrated by those who aren't Hispanic as well and who are religious as well. We just wanted to provide that space for people to join.
How did the Secular Day of the Dead observance get started?
So that got started with a mentorship between Margaret Downey and I. She saw me speaking at a convention, and, you know, luckily she picked me out and she said, "I would love to mentor you." And at the time I was in my early 20s, and I was really, you know, looking up to her, and I felt like this was the perfect opportunity for someone to kind of show me the ropes as far as speaking arrangements and how to conduct myself for interviews. And she kind of took me under her wing. And one weekend where we went over some ideas of what kind of events we wanted to present and how we wanted to get started throughout the secular community, this event came up. And I said, "Margaret, you know, I am Hispanic, but there are so many different traditions that are just tied to the Catholic Church. And I feel as though I'm just missing out on those now. You know, when so much of your life is tied to the church and then you suddenly find yourself without faith, mm-hmm. you also unfortunately find yourself without that community." And that's how I felt. And we were talking about it, and this idea of Day of the Dead came up. And, you know, Day of the Dead, it's really a celebration of life. So mm-hmm. regardless of what your faith is or what your background is, we all share in mourning and in loss and grief. So this event is really to honor those who have now passed away and to honor their legacy and to carry that on. And we really felt like it could resonate with a lot of Hispanics, non-theists, but of course, everybody.
And I'm really interested in, like, the first year, how did you get out the news about this, and how has it gone from the first year to where it is now?
So this was about 6 years ago in 2015. So it was way before people were usually doing Zoom. So we did do the flyers. We did do, you know, kind of a more hands-on efforts. We actually started in Southern California. I'm from San Diego. Margaret was also in Southern California. And we had our first ever Secular Day of the Dead in 2015 in San Diego, California. So it was a joint effort with a lot of hands-on volunteers. It was very much focused around family, which most of our traditions are. So we had a piñata, we had the Mexican buffet, and we invited people to actually come up and bring a photo of their loved ones and be open to speak about it. Mm-hmm. I was so grateful and surprised about how many people felt, you know, comfortable in that space we were providing. To honor their loved ones. We had a beautiful, what it's called an ofrenda. So it's like an honoring table, kind of similar to the one I have with, these are marigolds, and we have skulls and candles. And here, I don't know if you can see, but so this is a Frida candle.
Yeah, sure.
You also honor, you put your, you decorate your honoring table with photos of people you want to honor. Mm-hmm. So we had people actually, we had attendees actually bring photos of their loved ones if they felt comfortable, and take 3 to 5 minutes in talking about them mm-hmm. on a stage that we provided. Mm-hmm. It was so great. And from that one event, I knew that we had something special and I wanted to continue it.
What secular organizations are working together to present this year's observance?
So it's going to be the Freethought Society that we founded this event, and then Hispanic American Freethinkers, American Atheists, the Center for Inquiry, Freedom from Religion Foundation, the Secular Student Alliance, Atheists United, and then finally the Secular Coalition for America. Mm-hmm. They'll all be joining us this year.
You've given us a little bit of insight into what it's like. What would you say are the most important aspects of the way you observe the Day of the Dead?
I think the most important aspects for me would have to be the legacy that we leave behind. Mm-hmm. Because regardless of whether you believe in an afterlife or not, I personally don't. I still feel as though when you leave, you're gone. So what you leave your children, your family, those who've loved you, what you leave them is your legacy and leading a good life to remember you by. I hope one day when I'm gone, somebody will have me on their honoring table because of the life I've led and the examples I've shown them, whether it's through, writing books or doing charity, something that you leave behind in this world as your legacy. That's what's most important. And that's what we are trying to revive with Secular Day of the Dead.
Have you seen the impact of COVID?
I have. It's strange. I mean, I feel as though Day of the Dead for me was honoring, one person here or there or providing that space. Mm-hmm. But now with COVID, I mean, we're up to, I lost count. It's 700,000 now. Mm-hmm. You know, it's just, there is so much grief. And it's almost as though COVID has happened so fast and so quickly that we hit that 700,000 mark, mm-hmm. that some people didn't have time to mourn. Or they couldn't mourn because it was so early on in the pandemic that you couldn't safely get together. So last year when we did Secular Day of the Dead, that is definitely a point that we wanted to make. And we took some time to recognize that. And for people who, were impacted by COVID and they weren't able to mourn, mm-hmm. Or their mourning process was just so fast. I mean, this is a time again to really look back and reflect on that. In fact, Margaret Downey, the president of Free Thought Society, who is my co-host for the event, she's going to be honoring her mother who had died from COVID. Mm-hmm. So I think it's a really great space for, anybody who wants to do that.
Victoria, who would you encourage to take part in this year's celebration? And what are the details for how they can do that?
Well, Wilton, anybody is invited to join. There's no RSVP date. Of course, the earlier, the better. You can actually go on to ftsociety.org. It's the Free Thought Society homepage. It will have all the information that's needed, a meetup page. I think anybody who's interested in this event can join. However, if you want to take a few minutes to honor your loved one or a pet, of course, to honor your loved one, just, send us on over an email. Again, the information is all on ftsociety.org for the Free Thought homepage. Anybody is welcome, and we'd love to see who you're honoring.
Victoria De La Torre is co-founder of the Secular Day of the Dead, coming up November the 2nd. She is a board member for the Free Thought Society, which has hosted the Secular Day of the Dead since 2015, with Free Thought Society President Margaret Downey. Listen, thank you so much for doing this.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
This week, a joint appeal from the World Jewish Congress and Muslim World League reached the United Nations. The focus is religious freedom and safety for houses of worship. And I am really pleased to be joined now by Leon Saltiel, representative at UN Geneva and UNESCO and coordinator on countering anti-Semitism for the World Jewish Congress. Leon, welcome to State of Belief Radio.
Thank you so much. A great pleasure to be here with you.
Why this appeal to the United Nations now, and what is it about?
Thank you, Welton. Indeed, the World Jewish Congress, who represents Jews living in more than 100 countries, has founded a Muslim World League, a partner representing the Muslim faith, with whom we can cooperate and expand our dialogue on common issues and preoccupations. The meeting you're referring to happened at the headquarters of the United Nations in New York, where the chairman of the World Jewish Congress, Ambassador Ronald Lauder, and together with Sheikh Mohammed Alissa, the Secretary General of the Muslim World League, met jointly with Secretary General of the United Nations, Guterres. Mm-hmm. And this is, in fact, it's a step in a long process. It's a combination of many events that have been happening in the last few years. In April of this year, we hosted an interfaith Muslim-Jewish Ramadan dinner mm-hmm. with senior representatives of the Muslim and Jewish faith from all over the world, where each other wished to the participants best wishes and made remarks and pledges for peaceful coexistence and cooperation. And around 2 weeks ago, I had the great honor to deliver a joint statement on behalf of the two organizations before the UN Human Rights Council. The first ever, I believe, joint statement delivered by representatives of two major Muslim and Jewish groups before a UN body, where together we pledged cooperation, dialogue, and peaceful coexistence as a way to address many of the world's challenges that we're facing today.
What you put before the United Nations, do the brief of what you wanted the United Nations to hear.
We think that religious leaders have a role to play. And we enable a space to be created for dialogue and debate that often the states, the countries, the members of the UN, with their political interests, have a narrow space for dialogue. And we are seeking to enlarge this space. And we're seeking to put interfaith dialogue, and that's what our two leaders asked the Secretary General, mm-hmm. to prioritize interfaith dialogue as a way to address many of the challenges faced by the world, be it climate change, poverty, now we have the COVID-19 pandemic, of course, terrorism, conflict. We think that interfaith can play a decisive role in many of these questions. And that's what the plea I made before the Human Rights Council in Geneva. This is the plea our leaders made before the UN Secretary General, with the hope that by bringing not only Jewish and Muslim groups together, but also Christians and everybody else together, we can give answers and we can bring the governments and the peoples close to one another.
How was this joint message received?
I can say has been received quite positively. The fact that I'm speaking to you today, it's one of the echoes of this statement. It has been widely covered in the press. It was very widely, very warmly received, I could say, by the diplomatic community here in Geneva. And of course, as I say, this is one of the steps in a long process. We don't think that this statement is the final destination. It's a means to continue our cooperation, expand it, but also reach out to all other partners who want to join us. And as I say, sensitize governments and UN leaders about the importance of integrating religious leaders into their discussions.
There are a lot of people who would think that Jewish people and Muslim people would have very different ideas and positions on religious freedom. Would you talk about the history of interfaith cooperation between the World Jewish Congress and Muslim World League?
Both of our organizations and both of our faiths believe that all human beings are given the same freedoms and rights by our Creator, who is the same entity, the same person, the same Creator, the same force. And as I said, we're destined to live in liberty, prosperity, and equality, free from conflict, oppression, or harassment. So we come both from the same understanding about our role in the world today as individuals. At the same time, we believe that reaching out to Muslim groups helps bridge this divide that's often based on stereotypes or misunderstandings. Mm-hmm. The Muslim World League, they're reaching out to many different faiths. And I think it's important to show to the world that Muslims and Jews can speak to one another, can cooperate. There are a lot more things that unite us than they divide us. Mm-hmm. That we as individuals, especially living, let's say, in Europe, where I'm based, or in America, we have more things that unite us than divide us. I'll give you only a couple of examples. The issue of ritual slaughter of animals, which is one of the religious practices both of Judaism and Islam, is threatened in some European countries. Same thing like male circumcision. So some of the real issues that Jews and Muslims face in Europe are actually common. So for anybody who says we don't have the same understanding, they don't exactly are aware of the situation. Jews and Muslims in Europe are facing many of the challenges that are similar. So that's why this makes this cooperation even more meaningful. Mm-hmm.
What's the hope that you have for increasing these kinds of partnerships and the way that organized collaboration can influence how individual members of different communities are able to see one another and get to know one another?
We don't want to keep this conversation at the top level. We want this to trickle down to the grassroots, to the community level. As you know, all politics are local. So we want people, religious leaders, individuals working in communities, in cities, in towns, to be inspired by what we do at this top international level and bring these lessons back home. Mm-hmm. You know, if they see a Jewish and a Muslim leader meeting jointly with the UN Secretary General, this can happen also in their town, in their city, where a local mufti and a local rabbi together with the local priest can come together and speak a message of hope, peace, and coexistence. Mm-hmm. And that's our wish, that we enable also all these grassroots events, which many are already taking place, but to have even more take place by giving us, let's say, our blessing from the top level.
Yeah. Dr. Leon Saltiel is representative at UN Geneva and UNESCO and coordinator on countering anti-Semitism for the World Jewish Congress. This week, in partnership with the Muslim World League, they presented an urgent call for greater focus on religious freedom worldwide, as well as more protection for houses of worship. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you so much. It was a great pleasure.
Well, that's all the time we have for this week's show. Your donations help keep us on the air. Please consider making a tax-deductible gift as we celebrate 15 years of continuous broadcasting. Information on how to donate is available at stateofbelief.com. That's stateofbelief.com. Stay up to date by subscribing to the free weekly State of Belief podcast on iTunes or your favorite podcast platform. And take a moment to follow us on Facebook and Twitter and be a part of the conversation. Social media helps connect like-minded people in conversation and company. I'd ask you to share State of Belief with just one other person this week for whom you think this might be helpful. Our producer is Ray Kirstein. State of Belief Radio is a production of Interfaith Alliance. Become a member today at interfaithalliance.org. And be sure to join us next week for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. Until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. That's State of Belief.
The only one who could ever reach me was the son of a preacher man. The only boy who could ever teach me was the son of a preacher man. Yes, he was. He was. Mm-hmm.